From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all get foggy sometimes, but across this country, there's a rising cohort of Americans who were once sharp as tacks, who could recall that actor's name in that movie, who didn't miss a trick, but who today, well, lose the keys or need a moment to recall their own grandchild's name. With the passage of time, we all start losing some brain function. Some fraction of us face the scarier challenge of dementia. There are supplements, computer games, and more that claim to help. And then there's solid science. This hour On Point, the things we all really can do to keep the snap in our minds, to stay sharp. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you felt the need for something to clear your head, sharpen your mind? What works for you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a moment, we'll speak to two experts in mental cognition and the aging mind in particular. But first, just a minute on Alzheimer's, the big fear. The Alzheimer's Association International Conference has just wrapped up in Washington, D.C. It's been going on all week. It's billed as the world's largest dementia forum. Melissa Healy, health and science reporter for the Los Angeles Times, has been covering it. Melissa, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
The conference is part of what has us thinking about the brain this week. Everybody has issues to look at there as they get too busy or distracted or age. But Alzheimer's, of course, really gets people's attention. What do we need to know coming out of this conference? What are the headlines, Melissa?
Well, the headlines are probably a little anticlimactic. Mm-hmm. Progress on Alzheimer's disease, on treating Alzheimer's disease, has been steady but very slow. And, of course, that's obviously frustrating to people who find that they have that they've developed Alzheimer's disease, and the people who care for them. The progress basically has been focused on not so much finding a cure, but finding what scientists call disease modifying therapies, treatments that could prevent dementia symptoms from showing up in the first place, or that could stop or slow their progression. But it's a diabolical disease.
Is
very complex.
The disease-modifying angle, is that the same kind of thing we're likely to hear about today to keep anybody sharp, or are there special pharmaceuticals or techniques for early Alzheimer's sufferers?
Well, there's been a very strong focus on identifying who's most likely to develop Alzheimer's disease. That's partly because the drug treatments developed so far to treat Alzheimer's have been very ineffective at slowing its progress. So the idea increasingly among scientists is find the people who are most likely to go on to develop Alzheimer's disease, find them 10 or 15 years before any symptoms show up, and perhaps treat them then. And the notion would be, if you can prevent Alzheimer's disease, you can cure Alzheimer's disease. That obviously isn't a great comfort to people who already have it and their caregivers.
But I guess I probably can't fend it off doing crossword puzzles.
Definitely not. The idea that people who stay engaged intellectually, who stay engaged socially, that they develop what's called a kind of a cognitive reserve, a sort of they're fortified against the effects of Alzheimer's disease. It has lots of evidence for it. Certainly, it's true. But the problem is that, again, this is a diabolical disease of the brain, and eventually the progress of the disease itself will catch up. And even people who have managed to stave off the symptoms, and many do for many years, on the strength of their so-called cognitive reserve, but eventually it catches up with you.
We all want to build that cognitive reserve. We're going to talk about how to do it today. Melissa Healy's been covering the big Alzheimer's conference in Washington this week for the Los Angeles Times. Melissa, thanks for joining us for a minute.
My pleasure.
With me now from Dallas, Sandra Bond Chapman, cognitive neuroscientist, founder and chief director of the Center for Brain Health, and distinguished university professor at the University of Texas at Dallas, author of Make Your Brain Smarter. Sandra Bond Chapman, Sandy, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hello, Tom. Great to be here.
And with us from New York is Kathleen Taylor, an expert in adult brain development and learning, a researcher and professor at the School of Education at St. Mary's College of California, author of the forthcoming book, Facilitating Brain-Aware Adult Learning. That all sounds good. Kathleen Taylor, thank you for being with us.
So glad to be here. Sorry, it's such a mouthful.
Yeah, that's all right. We're still capable of getting that mouthful out. We talk about aging, but it's not only people who are aging who think about this and worry about it. As soon as we put out that we were going to be talking about this, and we said for aging brains, on Twitter, we had DJ Tiger Necklace responding to us about the aging brain, saying, "But what if my brain gets out of shape before then?" Exclamation mark, question mark, before aging. Sandy Bond Chapman, is this an issue for people right across the age spectrum? How much more of this concern about staying sharp comes into play as aging really sets in, and at what age?
Yes, thank you, Tom, and what a great response, because, you know, we can't wait till our brain has completely left us to start worrying about us. We start very young with teenagers, the young adult brain, and it's just like if you were to say, I'm going to wait to brush my teeth until they fall out. We know that the more you keep your brain strong early, the more it can continue to build strengths. So younger and continuous workout is what's required.
Younger and continuous workout. That sounds like something you do at the gym. What do you mean by workout, Sandy?
Yeah, and it's with us, we're looking in our randomized trials at the Center for Brain Health to define what can rewire the brain, what can strengthen it. And it requires more just taking information in, how well you remember every single thing you've ever learned, but really more, how do you synthesize? How do you interpret, transform when our brain uses these broad-based ways to connect dots is how we strengthen connections. And so that's really what we're interested in, to build strength of cognitive function, is to think in these complex ways. So it's not keeping it busy all the time. When people say use it or lose it, I say, no, we're using our brains so much right now, we're burning it up.
And yet, even people who have pretty active minds can feel a little drifting coming in. Here was Ellen DeGeneres on her show in May, talking about how she's getting forgetful as she gets older. And in her routine, she shares a story about forgetting twice.
The other day during rehearsal, they played a song for me to dance to. And I was like, what's this song? I've never heard it before. And my producer said, you have. You danced to it. I said, I have not. And he said, you have too. And I said, I have not. Did I tell the story already? Darn it.
A comedian can have good fun with it. Kathleen Taylor, you look at adult learning. Do you see talk about learning curves. Do you see a curve that tapers off? Does capacity just diminish? Is that necessary? Or are there ways for most people to keep it going strong?
Absolutely. And I'd really like to take the word learning and stretch it out a little bit. Mm-hmm. In essence, the brain is always learning. And we're not necessarily talking about what goes on in a classroom or what goes on when somebody else is directing your traffic, so to speak. But when the brain is functioning, it is by definition learning. The question is, how do we have it functioning at capacity, or how do we have it functioning well throughout our lifetimes? And the overview of this is actually in some ways the simplest, and I very much respect the work that Sandra is doing. I look at it more broadly. What's good for the body is good for the brain, and we can't forget the fact that the brain is very much embodied, and so what goes on in the rest of the body actually ends up going on in the brain at some point. So, for example, diet matters, and exercise matters, and sleep matters. And in fact, I have a little mnemonic I use, dessert, which has nothing to do
Remind us. We'll be too quick to go over that. Okay.
But it's diet, exercise, sleep, socialize, relax, and think. And all of those are important to do in a consistent way, and especially as you get older, because we get busy. And so some of those things sort of drop out of our awareness, or we don't pay them as much attention as we should, or we think, I'll take care of that tomorrow. But it's really possible to create a more brain-aware way of being in the world, which will take care of the brain as it indeed takes care of the rest of the body.
Okay, news you can use. We'll start with this list and we'll go beyond it. But Sandy, I'm just pick that up to begin with. Diet, exercise, socialize, relax, think. I have to say, to me, that just sounds like living. Is it really a problem accomplishing those things?
Yeah, I think we tend to take a sedentary lifestyle mentally as well as physically. In terms of we just want to be fed and absorb. But our brain was wired to create new information constantly. It loves to innovate. And so figuring out things that you're passionate about, we see the brain actually be strengthened and rewire quicker when it's engaged in innovative thinking. And we get lazy. We just want to say, tell me what I need to know and I'll go do it, rather than creating new ways of looking at things. And, you know, we see it in young children where they get so excited about new learning, and our brain loves that for the entire part of our life to create new knowledge and new ways of looking at things. It hates status quo, and it goes backwards, just being a vast computer storage of information.
So in a way, this is sort of the Sheryl Sandberg message, lean into life, and you're halfway there. It almost sounds, Kathleen, like there's a fundamental attitude that may come first.
Absolutely. And one of the things that's true about the brain is that the areas that deal with social interaction were created a lot earlier than the areas that deal with what we would call cognitive interaction.
Okay.
The brain is a social brain. And a couple of hundred million years ago, who's counting? And so when we engage with others, when we engage in social activities, we are actually strengthening the brain. Of course, it's wonderful to do specific cognitive activities, but one doesn't have to engage in those. For example, think. Think doesn't mean that you are doing a particular cognitive function that has a right answer. It means that you are using your brain to solve the everyday problems of life. But the important part is to do it differently than you always do, because the brain creates patterns, and it would just as soon follow in the patterns it's been in. But those are unfortunately leading to more rigidity rather than more flexibility.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about keeping your brain in shape. As you age, anytime, as you're challenged, looking at the fads, the hype, what really works? With Kathleen Taylor. She is a researcher, professor at School of Education, St. Mary's College of California, author of Facilitating Brain-Aware Adult Learning, coming out very soon. Sandra Bond Chapman is with us from Dallas, founder and chief director of the Center for Brain Health. She's there at the University of Texas at Dallas, author of Make Your Brain Smarter. Of course, there are plenty of folks who will sell you something to do with your brain. Luminosity is an online brain training neuroscience research company based in San Francisco. It markets online games that they say will, quote, make your brain better.
I do it to stay sharp. I take care of my body, but it was harder to work out my brain. Well, Lumosity.com is based on neuroscience, and it just seems like games, but it's serious brain training.
Any brain can get better, and Lumosity.com can help. It's like a personal trainer for your brain, improving your performance with the science of neuroplasticity, but in a way that just feels like games.
Okay, we'll look at brain training you can buy and what our guests think of it. And we also have lots of advice from our listeners here. Let me go. Mark says, learn to play music. Doesn't sound bad. Madeline says, meditate. Marie, get enough quality sleep. Keep reading. Stay involved with your community, a network of friends and family. Wendell says, run, ski, play tennis, play guitar, do crosswords and Sudoku. Eat organic and locally grown. Donnie says, eat oysters. Lots and lots of oysters. I have no idea. Thomas is sort of tweaky here. He says, I plan on writing lots of complaint comments on your Facebook pages to keep my wits sharp. Okay. And Jeannie, this is a money marketing thing. If you are doing a show on it, just be aware of the profiteering on so-called brain improvement scams. Let's start with the last, if we may. Sandy, what do you make of this sort of brain training you can buy? There are lots of things out there. Luminosity is just one of them. What about that path?
Yeah, I think it is really important for us to think, what are we doing with our brain? Because it is very specific how we use it. It changes every single moment. And so when you're practicing these games, to realize that you're getting better and better at the games, and it makes you feel good. But for us, what we want to know, is it making you better at decision-making and judgment and higher order things that keep you an independent living person. And that's what the science hasn't shown. But indeed, you get better speed of processing, some of these visual patterns, but and the processes don't spill up to make you better at complex thinking. So when people, what I usually tell people when they ask me, I do Sudoku, and I say, yeah, you're going to be King Kong of Sudoku, but you're not going to be better at making decisions for your life. And so when I see people on the airplane when they could be resting and they're doing crossword puzzles or Sudoku, I said, you know what? It'd be better if you took a nap.
Okay. All right. Kathleen, help us out here, because this may just confuse people, because, you know, we want to have that kind of tick, tick, tick sharpness that may come with this kind of Sudoku or whatever it may be, luminosity stuff. But we also want to have the higher order mental power at all ages in life. How do you look at the packaged products that are out there on the market, Kathleen?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Sandra. The games are great for making you better at the things the games make you better at. And that's fine. The transferability is unclear. There are some studies that have seemed to say that whatever the improvements are last for a long time. Without getting too technical, those samples are not necessarily representative of the samples of everyday people. They tend to be a little bit more educated. They tend to be a little bit more white. And the kind of development that the game improves is not necessarily transferable to will you find your keys or to do you understand the way to approach a particular problem.
Interesting.
So by all means, you know, have fun, engage. My suggestion, if you want a twofer, is go find a social game. I mean, playing a game online is fine, but who are you talking to? The computer. Rather, lots of people I know play bridge. It has the double benefit of it is a challenging game, mm-hmm. and you're with other people. Similarly, go volunteer somewhere. Now, that isn't a game, but you can be doing something that's social, that's meaningful. And I want to emphasize the meaningful part, that when we engage with other people in ways that they feel better, we actually feel better. And that's good for your brain because it slushes some dopamine through there. And that's a very positive kind of environment for your brain to begin. It's the opposite with something like cortisol, which is an anxiety hormone, mm-hmm. which you want less of. So an important part of keeping your brain healthy is to reduce stress. And Sandra mentioned, for example, relaxation of various kinds, meditation. Even just taking 4 or 5 deep breaths every so often will actually trigger the relaxation response in your brain and lower cortisol. So you don't have to go find a game to improve how your brain is functioning.
You suggest it. I find myself doing it, and I feel it already just as quick as that. Everybody's paying attention. Whitney writes to us on Twitter, I'm only in my 30s, but everything from my livelihood to my daily life revolves around my brain, so I kind of need that thing. Everybody wants to keep it in good shape. Ryan, in Buffalo, New York, you're on the air with Kathleen and Sandy. Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
What's your solution or question, Ryan? Hello, Ryan, are you there?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
You're on the air, Ryan. What do you have to say?
So I've actually been a member of MNSA for a few years now. I'm 35 years old, and I use a lot of different methods to try to do the studying and try to keep my brain active. I learn multiple languages. I study them in my free time. It's Sudoku, and I'm really terrified of the concept of mental atrophy. That's the one thought that just it gives me chills. And I want to see, are there any strategies that are perhaps more successful than others to try to maybe progress or be more diverse and to ensure that the brain capacity stays where it is, or I can minimize or mitigate any potential loss over the course of time.
Ryan, rough line, but I think we've got it. Terrified of mental atrophy. I mean, that's why we're all here talking about this, right? Nobody wants that. We've begun to hear some elements of it. But, Sandy, if I come in, sit down with you, and you spend a couple of minutes just sort of laying out the elements here, you gave us your diet, exercise, socialize, relax, think. Put some more structure around that, if you would. Those are broad. Take us into a little more granular detail.
Yeah, so one of the things that we teach, we give people 9 strategies that I spelled out in the book, Make Your Brain Smarter. And it's preparing the brain to use these broad networks, frontal lobe, your parietal lobe, that does all these association. So it's just as much what you don't do. So we teach people right away to stop multitasking. Mm-hmm. Your brain, when you're doing two things at once, is toggling back and forth, and it breaks down the neural connections. It increases cortisol. It increases depression, and it literally fragments your cognitive power.
So focus on the thing you are doing. This may be good advice for our 30-something Whitney here. At that age, you can have, you know, career,
yes,
kids, all kinds of things going on. Multitasking becomes very tempting.
Yes. So, and as a society, we've built it. We've bought into it. We think that's what's required. And surely if I'm doing 2, 3, 5 things at once, it must be better for our brain. And science is very clear that your brain is not wired to do two things at once. It's quickly toggling. You make more errors. It decreases productivity. So it's very devastating. We also teach people to stop information downloading. It's not, you know, you would think today we're exposed to 200 times more information than we were just 20 years ago, and it is at an extreme cost because we have much shallower processing. So we tell people, if you will be an expert in two things rather than 100 articles, you will be much better at deeper level thinking.
Does that mean skip the social media plan here, or
that
could be a tall order for a generation coming up?
This Google brain is really, how do you use our technology to support the brain? One of the most common questions I'm asked is, technology good or bad for your brain? And I say, yes, it is.
Thanks a lot, Obi-Wan. Zen cone. It's both. Huh?
Yes. Yeah, so we want to use it, right, to maximize and not have to stuff our memory banks, but then to be quickly downloading so much information that we never can think a thought, reflect on it. That's really what allows our brain to build these connections physically stronger.
What about diet? It comes up in all these questions, people really wanting to know if that makes a difference over time in our mental clarity, acuity, even higher order thinking, as you say.
Yeah, so the diet is, you know, the evidence is looking like the Mediterranean diet, to, you know, eat fruit, nuts, vegetables, legumes, olive oil, reduced meat, dairy products, sweets. But one of the things that's the easiest to remember is eat real food. It's the preservatives that are making us sicker, you know, as we're eating food that's been prepared. So eat real food, you know, just regular quantities of it.
If you have to tear open a whole lot of packaging, you may be on the wrong path.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry
Thank
in Lexington, you. Kentucky. Jerry, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell Sandra that what she's saying is really, really good to my ears about the, you know, taking concern about the whole body health aspect and about stopping the multitasking. I teach for a trade, and I see students always trying to multitask, and this gives me food for thought for them about stopping the multitasking. And the words of Heraclitus back, the Greek philosopher centuries ago, said that when you do two things at one time, you do nothing. So,
very good.
Heraclitus foreseeing the digital age there, the Google mind. Pretty good, Harry.
Yeah, and one thing is, I'm a sponsor for, the reason I'm calling, I'm a sponsor for my chess club at the high school. So, yes, the chess game of chess is great, but talking back and forth to the students about the chess moves, I agree, is as important. Especially in my mind, as I take care of my mother, who's right now, you know, 94 and is in her 8th year of Alzheimer's and clinging in the life, you know, final life stage. So, and we take care of her 24/7, and, you know, plays in my mind, you know, can this be my route? Is this going to be my end game? So,
Jerry, when you're playing chess, are you thinking to yourself, maybe I'm putting off my mother's path?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Of course, I love the game of chess,
yeah.
But more than that, keeping, it's real good food for the brain, in keeping my brain active, and, you know, and it, the game of chess is wonderful. There are other games out there. You said bridge, and I'm sure there's checkers and so forth, but this is the passion that I have, and you talked about passion for a game.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found that reading and learning and keeping the brain active has been really good for me, because I'm one of those who lose the keys all the time. Mm-hmm. So I go, you know, I don't want to end up like my mom, but, you know, genetics is, forever. So you gotta pay attention to that as well.
Jerry, I appreciate your passion right there. I'm sure we all do. And your commitment to your mom. That is a beautiful thing. Kathleen Taylor, chess is Jerry's, and he doesn't just look at it as moving pieces on a board. He looks at it as the socializing around it as well, with his mother over his shoulder there and her Alzheimer's. You're a learning expert. How do you think about learning? Does that mean taking courses and learning about Heraclitus, or does it mean playing chess, or do they both count?
All of the above and more. I go back to something one of your previous callers said, is that he's a Mensa member and he's been learning languages.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's absolutely fantastic. And one good thing that you might do with all those languages is go where the people talk them. Now, what I'm saying by that is put yourself in new environments, put yourself in new cultural environments, in new thinking environments. That is one of the most important things we can do, is not allow our brains to go into their typical patterns. And they will do that because the brain takes up 20 to 25% of your waking energy, but mm-hmm. that's only 2 to 3% of your body weight. So it's an energy hog. And the way it deals with that is to create these shortcuts in your neural networks. And the more often it takes that shortcut, the more frequently it wants to take that shortcut, because that's going to save energy, which is great, and it also has a downside. And the downside is it keeps us from stretching. It keeps us from looking at something in a different way. It keeps us from experiencing something that would challenge those networks. And that's one of the more important things we can do when we say learning. We don't have to mean that in terms of a formal learning environment, though they're obviously great. And there's all kinds of courses and classes and environments adults can find themselves in that will give them those opportunities without necessarily being in a degree program of some kind. That said, being in a position where you're going to come up against something which is not familiar to you and where you're going to have to think about it in a new way, that's the best kind of brand food you can manage.
Then maybe, Kathleen, we live in the best of times. I mean, this is not the age of people sitting under the old oak tree, the shade of the old oak tree, and nothing changing around them. We've got demographic change, cultural change, technological change, just existing in our society today. You're confronting change.
Yes, and we have the tendency to avoid it. In other words, we tend to see the same folks, we tend to go to the same places, we tend to see the same kinds of read the same kinds of books, go to the same movies. Yeah. Here's a wonderful example, I don't want the cruise industry picketing my lawn.
Okay.
But cruises are a case in point. First of all, the demographic of folks who take cruises tends to be a limited one.
Yes.
Then what do you have? You see these beautiful ads, and a lot of them are on NPR, for going to exotic locales and seeing all kinds of fantastic art and eating new foods.
And then back to your familiar stateroom.
Exactly. First of all, you're with a whole group of people you're with for the entire cruise.
Yeah.
You get off the ship. You go on the tour bus. You take the tour bus to the interesting place to go with your same people. You eat in the restaurant, interesting foods that have been designed for the tour so that they're not a little too exotic. I think you get the picture. We create a bubble that matches the bubble we're most familiar with.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about keeping your brain sharp, keeping your brain in shape with Kathleen Taylor at the School of Education at St. Mary's College of California, author of Facilitating Brain-Aware Adult Learning, coming out soon. Sandy Bond Chapman is with us, author of Make Your Brain Smarter. She's at the University of Texas at Dallas at the Center for Brain Health there. We're hearing advice here from Kathleen and Sandy. You know, have a good diet, exercise, the body above all, socialize, relax, think, change, mix it up. Don't let your brain fall into too familiar patterns. People sharing us with us here online. Jen says, improv comedy games. Mm-hmm. It's social, requires quick thinking. That sounds pretty good. Keith says he started running marathons at age 40. I can feel the clouds, frustration, anxiety lift post-run. Keith writes, brain equal body. His advice, exercise. And then Tully writes in, how to keep my brain sharp? By listening to On Point Radio, of course. Yay, we celebrate this one. Melissa in Arlington, Massachusetts. Melissa, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you do?
Well, one of my favorite hobbies is dancing. I do lots of different types of dancing with my husband and with a number of friends who I've developed over the years.
Like foxtrot or ballet or modern dance or all of the above? What?
Well, in the Boston area, folk dancing is a very popular thing to do. So we do contra dancing. We do couples dancing at mostly waltz. Events that take place monthly during the school year, usually.
So it keeps your body nimble. What about your mind? What about your mind, Melissa? You got a nimble body out of that, no doubt.
No. And there's also modern Western square dancing, mm-hmm. which absolutely requires and develops a nimble mind because you're constantly having to think and process what the caller is telling you to do. So I'm curious. I feel like I've read articles on the subject of dancing being, it's a wonderful mm-hmm. social activity. It's a wonderful physical activity. It is definitely a brain activity. I'm curious to know what your guests would have to say about that.
Kathleen, yeah, it sounds like a bullseye, sort of physical,
absolutely.
Mental, social all at once.
Yeah, I'm familiar with contra dance and some of the others that your caller mentioned. And in fact, it does involve your brain because there is a complexity to the dance that you have to follow. And it's also a social activity. And it's also an aerobic activity. And it also involves music. I mean, it, in many ways, it really does hit on a lot of chords that are a good environment for the brain to be operating in. And I'd like to go back to your caller who said that improv is a wonderful activity for a very interesting reason. Mm-hmm. They have a rule in improv, which is you can't say no. In other words, when someone throws a line
you're
at you,
challenged,
you don't
right.
have, absolutely, you don't have a choice to say, well, I want you to change that line. You have to go with it so that it really requires that you move forward.
Right.
In whatever way
whatever
you can.
Whatever it is. Speak as a radish.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'll speak as a radish. I don't know what that is, but we'll try.
That's what I mean about thinking differently, about having to move where your brain doesn't always want to go.
Sandy, take us to the social piece of this. I mean, maybe it's obvious, but unravel that a little bit. How does socializing connect with sharp-mindedness?
Yeah, the socializing piece, we actually have looked at social cognition and people engaging in deeper conversation versus just shallow. And I like what Kathleen said, when you have the same friends, the same conversation, even with your spouse is, hello, honey, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. Fine. Mm-hmm. But it's when you talk deeper and think about things that you not only bond stronger, that gets the oxytocin. And when we engage in deeper conversation with our friends, it is probably one of the most protective things for our brain. And it's important young. We know that the technology is keeping people from developing stronger bonds, although they may have a lot more vast social networks. It's really the depth of the friendships that you have that looks like it builds this social reasoning in these frontal parietal lobes that makes you solve complex problems. You know, I think, and I want to go back, you know, I think it was Jerry that was talking about chess.
Yes.
87% of the people will not develop Alzheimer's disease.
87% of chess players?
Of people in general.
Okay.
Will not develop. He was worried about Alzheimer's disease. So he's saying, I'm playing chess and I see my mom. But I want people realizing that we can do more in healthy people. It's not either I'm fine or I've got Alzheimer's. It's let's do something. And 42 is about the best age that, as we look at longitudinal studies, when our brain is the sharpest. And it doesn't have to be like that. If we start in our 20s and 30s, and chess is something, I've actually have a young man in high school that is teaching chess to early Alzheimer's patients, and we're doing a randomized trial to see if, in fact, it can help them reason better. So it's important to realize that we can do a lot to stave off Alzheimer's for 2 to 5 years, but in healthy people, we don't want our peak brain age to be 42.
You're saying most people peak out mentally at 42. As a 50-something guy, I feel like there's no way I peaked out then.
I know. Well, see, you're a reporter, and we actually teach people how to use exercises in everything they do. And you as a reporter getting the synthesized message, how do I expand this to a broader audience? Think like a reporter is one of the key messages that we tell people. How do you take a long message and boil it down to the essence and abstract it? That is the best exercise you can do mentally.
Go deep, go rich, go wide. It sounds like be vital and synthesize. Yeah. That's a kind of ongoing process of putting things together.
Even improv, whatever you're doing, you can do it constantly. It's not like a physical exercise where you have to go off 30 minutes or an hour a day. This is something you can use throughout your whole day. We're training high-performance Navy SEALs, executives, corporate, and mental productivity. Getting the Windex out and spraying your brain to clear, how can I think clearly, is important for us to realize in health.
Be vital. I'm hearing that all over. We've got people asking about, and I want to ask both of you about this, about supplements. You know, whether it's just kind of homespun notions or real science, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of things out there, ginkgo biloba and so on, that people think about, well, maybe if I take this pill or eat this particular supplement, it will sharpen my brain. I'll come first to you, Sandy, and then you, Kathleen. What do you think about supplements? Do they have a place? Is there any science saying they actually help, Sandy?
You know, the science is still not there in terms of strong evidence-based trials. We know that omega-3 is really important for the developing brain. There are some of the supplements like turmeric, red pepper, that looks like it's good for chronic inflammation. And when you have inflammation in the brain, it literally chips away at cognitive reserve and takes it down. So I think that there's not going to be a single pill that will be good. And we're spending billions of dollars on supplement with no evidence because it's not driven by the FDA. I think it's going to be a multiple level, like we've talked about. Some supplements, eat real food, but really the complex thinking is what's going to allow you to build the complex brain networks that keep you stronger, not only in your 40s, but into your 90s.
So omega-3, if I eat any more salmon, I'm going to swim away, but okay. Turmeric, I'll keep making Indian food. Red pepper, sure. Bring it on. Kathleen Taylor, what about the supplements path?
Well, if one thinks about them as supplements as opposed to as a way to avoid eating a good diet, clearly there's a big difference.
Forget
there.
About it.
I really do want to go back to one of the basics, which is that the brain is embodied, and what's good for the body is good for the brain. Mm-hmm. And please let us not forget that a half hour of aerobic exercise every other day. It's good for your heart. If it's good for your heart, it's good for your brain. It oxygenates the brain. It makes certain that there's those little capillaries are working. It is one of the simplest things you can do, and anybody can exercise. You don't have to go to the gym. You don't have to take up tennis. Take as brisk a walk as you can manage, and definitely smell the flowers. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is something specific, because one of the areas, when we talk about relaxation, we're really talking about lowering stress. And we mentioned the relaxation response. But there's another aspect to this, and that is what I call a sense of wonderment. In other words, putting yourself in a frame of mind where you are aware that there is something bigger than yourself. For some people, this is in a formalized spirituality. Perhaps it's prayer. For some, it's in meditation. For others, it's in nature. And there is that sense of wonderment, of, and it absolutely bathes the brain in the good kinds of hormones. Also, when you're engaged with other people, which is by itself a good thing, if you can engage in a way that it is compassionate and caring, that also, as Sandra said, that releases oxytocin. In other words, there are many ways that we can live our lives that are going to be healthy for our brains that are also just a wonderful way to live our lives.
You know, this is sounding better and better. I mean, I thought I had to become some kind of crossword puzzle galley slave, but a sense of wonder and exercise, eat well, be with people, relax. I mean, it just sounds like good living, really good, rich living. Warren in New Orleans. Warren, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I've been taking foreign language by audio courses, doing a few of them, and that seems to – it's fun, first of all. But
yes.
I was wondering if there were any studies that indicated how that helped brain activity.
May we inquire, Warren, what languages you've been dipping into?
Spanish, actually.
Fantastic.
You know, my family and I went to Spain a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And did that in preparation for that and just have kept with it.
Kathleen, it sounds in your corner here, language learning as we
Absolutely.
Roll along.
And the part I liked best, James, is that you went to Spain and that you ate Spanish food and that you looked at Spanish art and that you talked to Spanish people. That sounds like some of the best parts of that language learning. That said, of course, it is actually good to be making the kinds of connections that language learning requires, because it does indeed get you out of your brain's normal habits of language. So all those things are good. And when the context can be expanded so that you are, in fact, expanding your circle of how you move in the world, mm-hmm. it's even better.
Don't get lost in the headset. Take what you've learned out as quick as you can and speak that Spanish. Francisco is calling from Chelsea, Massachusetts. Francisco, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
My question is, how about subjects such as philosophy and religion, theology? I have a little bias here. I'm a student at BU of philosophy and religion.
Marvelous.
But I find very useful of putting the brain through the exercise of thinking about abstract ideas,
mm-hmm.
Often found in philosophy and religion. The big questions, the very, very significant symbolic ideas.
I have a feeling where our guests are going to take us with that, Francisco, but I'm so glad you raise it. We're all going to be Talmudic scholars here, but what about philosophy, theology, the big abstract stuff? Sandy?
Yeah, you know, this is where the brain, you know, some of these more liberal arts, philosophy, where you connect ideas across disciplines is really where we're going with thinking. They've shown that the more silo thinking is keeping people from creating a future world, but just to learn the knowledge as it exists in very concrete courses is not preparing youth for a future. So philosophy, abstract thinking, thinking from multiple perspectives brings in that social part. That's where we get, you know, these, the part of your brain that makes us uniquely human is really this complex frontal network that allows us to reason. So engaging in philosophy and religion where there's not a single interpretation or a single answer, the more perspectives and the older we get, the better we are. You know, I don't want us to lose sight of, well, things like memory and speed of processing may be getting slower as we age. There are key things that should get better and better. And one of those is abstract thinking, synthesizing, seeing things from so many diverse areas. And that's something we see that can be impaired early, early, early in Alzheimer's that we've been looking at, and we've been able to almost predict who's going to develop it. So these are areas that are very important. So keep it up.
I'd like to bring up
yes,
one
Kathleen.
Of I'd like to bring up one of the better longitudinal studies. It happens to be called the Nun Study because it was done with a group of cloistered women, which turns out not to be the important factor. They have been studied for well over 40 years, and given varying tests at various times to check on their cognitive function and, mm-hmm. and all manner of other metrics. They also willed their brains to science so that after they died, they were autopsies of the brains. Here's the fascinating part. It is definitely the case that those who were teachers, those who maintained an active interest in other people, those who kept learning, had the least cognitive decline as measured. The interesting part is that on autopsy, some of those women actually had the plaques and the tangles that are associated with a brain that has advanced dementia, but they did not have evidence of it in their lives
wow.
or on the metrics.
They somehow lived around it.
Absolutely. Well, I don't know about lived around it, but some of the ways in which we define dementia, some of the ways mm-hmm. that we think we know what it is, their learning, their activity, their sociability, their religious or spiritual connection, which does not have to, as Sandy said, identify with a particular religion. All of these factors seem to make an enormous difference in their cognitive capacity into their 80s and 90s.
And Bill's cognitive reserve.
Mm-hmm. Cognitive reserve. My conclusion at the end of this hour is that staying sharp is going to be a blast. It sounds like the best way to live. Live well, live richly, be fully engaged, keep that body moving, and hopefully our minds will come right along with it. Sandra Bond Chapman at the University of Texas at Dallas, author of Make Your Brain Smarter. You're so great to be with us. Thank you very much, Sandy.
Enjoyed it. Thank you, Tom.
And Kathleen Taylor, look for her facilitating brain-aware adult learning. Kathleen, thank you so much for being with us today.
My great pleasure.
Good luck, everybody. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.